And thanks for coming. It's early this morning. I appreciate everyone taking the effort to get up, and I know it was hard for me. It probably hard for you too. Let's start off with giving you just a little layout of what I want to talk about. My goal here is to give a slightly more rigorous framework for talking about the politics of vulnerabilities than simply, you know, the researchers hate the vendors and the vendors hate the government and that kind of thing. We'll try to be a little bit more detailed about how some of these relationships come to be and what the power relationships between the various actors are. Just a quick little background here. Who has taken a political science course in college or high school or whatever? Who's taken one? A couple of them? Good? Good? Quite a few. Very good. Anyone a political science major? No. Okay. I was a social sciences major as an undergraduate and did a master's in sociology, which is my major qualification for doing information security, but is probably more of a qualification for giving this particular talk. So here's the layout that we're going to do. It's going to give you a quick background into sort of what politics is. From the number of you who have had political science before, you some of this will be a little bit old hat for you. I'll go fairly quickly, but the meat of the presentation is in the integration of the ideologies, the actors, and some of the initiatives that are taking place in public policy arena right now. I should have mentioned, by the way, in addition to doing information security for BindView, I also run our public affairs program. Relate with government and that kind of stuff. So some of the things that you'll be hearing, I think everything, hopefully everything I'm saying is in the public domain. It is after I say it anyway. And then at the end, I'll just do a little bit of crystal ball stuff of sort of where I think the trends are going in the future. So politics, contrary to what you would think if you were reading papers, is really the study of power. And power we define as the ability to make someone do what they would not otherwise do, which is a fairly straightforward definition. There are a number of ways that you could slice that to different people disagree on what that actually means, but you know, for our purposes, that's probably good enough to give you the basic idea here. Politics, by the way, in the American newspapers tends to be sort of, you know, he said, she said, and what the scandal of the day is, and who's going to, you know, cough up the money for whatever. But it's really sort of does the disservice to the actual study of how we decide who gets to decide how to make people do things that they would not otherwise do. So some important terms for you. Actor, in the Hollywood sense, but in the sense of the one who uses or is subject to power. So it's a person or an entity of some kind. Could be corporate, could be government, could be any number of things. Could be an individual as well certain contexts. An ideology is a set of beliefs or ideas, should be fairly straightforward. Pardon me, and legitimacy is an important concept also, which is essentially in accordance with established standards and patterns, what we sort of believe to be the thing that is okay. That's the rough definition of legitimacy. And authority is legitimate power, which is an important concept that we'll hit on a little bit later in the presentation for understanding how it comes to be that certain people decide that it's okay to do certain things. Okay? Vulnerability, I'm sure this is probably a crowd that doesn't need a lot of definition here, but it's important to remember that not everybody agrees on what exactly constitutes a vulnerability. Okay? There are particularly academic researchers who basically think that a vulnerability is only a flaw in software. If the software is behaving in the way that it is intended to behave, for example, if you've set a blank password on the root account on a Unix machine, excuse me, and somebody is able to log in with that, that is not a vulnerability. There's no flaw there, right? The software is behaving in the way that it was intended to behave. Okay? We are using a slightly more generous definition of vulnerability in the, for our purposes here, to include misconfigurations or misuses of software operating systems. So the example of a blank password for root would in fact constitute a vulnerability in our definition of things. So we're casting the net fairly wide to pull things in, and I'm not going to go into the examples of what vulnerabilities do. I'm sure these are things that all of us are very familiar with. The major ideologies that are in play with regard to vulnerabilities relate to the what you do with vulnerability information, which is essentially disclosure, or the lack thereof. And the spectrum ranges from full disclosure to through what is, I've taken the term responsible disclosure, which is, I understand, we know is a loaded term, right? So is full disclosure, for that matter. All of these terms have a fair amount of baggage in the way that they've been used, and I'm not going to question particularly those labels. You can certainly make a case that there are good and bad things about the different ways of referring to these, but that will sort of bracket that discussion. If we want to do that in the question and answer period, that's fine. I'd be happy to talk about those things as well. Okay. So what is full disclosure, and what are the basic ideas here? The tenets are sort of information wants to be free, dude, you know, the happy-go-lucky, everybody wants to share information, we want to tell everybody everything there is to know. And the positive aspect of this is really that the idea here is to use the power of public opinion, right, to harness the idea that people are, somebody's doing something that they shouldn't be doing, in order to make people do something. Right? This is a basic power relation. Right? Harness the public opinion. Okay, Microsoft is doing something bad, therefore they need to fix it. Right? And so we, as the researcher or as the person who conducts the disclosure, is trying to produce this effect. We're trying to wield power to produce an effect and to make the vendor do what they would not otherwise do. Right? And there's an important piece here also, which is that exploit code is more useful than destructive. I don't know if anybody sat in on the vulnerability disclosure panel that was on last evening, this concept was not really questioned at that, but it's an important thing to remember. Most people who publish exploit code are not doing so for the purpose of causing people to be broken into. They're not doing it to be evil in most cases. Right? There are people who do that as well, but most people who are doing it for who are doing exploits for the black hat purposes generally don't publish. In fact, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But the idea of publishing the exploit code is to make it useful, so people can do independent verification of their IDS system, so they can test for the existence of the vulnerability, do the things that they need to do in order to make use of the vulnerability, in order to improve those, to fix the vulnerability. Okay? Most of the folks who are sort of in this category are generally nonprofit researchers, meaning people who are hobbyists, and I'll talk more about what that group of actors in the next couple of slides, and some commercial researchers. Okay, there's an important distinction to make between researchers who are getting paid to do their research and researchers who are getting paid to do something else and do research on the side. Okay? There are very few other groups that actually believe that full disclosure is a good idea. The so-called responsible disclosure is essentially the same ideas as full disclosure, but the power relationship here is the same. The disclosure, the point of the disclosure is to generally cause the vendor to improve their code, although there may also be other factors that are going into it as well. And again, I'll talk about that when I talk about the researchers. But also, there's an important distinction here in exploit code, which is the central difference from full disclosure, being that exploit code is more harmful than good. Right? Putting it out there may allow people to do good things, like test their systems, da 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 da, but it has the bad effect of putting the ability to exploit the vulnerability in the hands of people who are going to use it for no good, and so we don't want to avoid that. Right? So that's the central crux there. But also, there's a belief that it is necessary to broadly disclose vulnerability information for a variety of purposes, to warn system administrators that they need to install their patches or change their configurations to fix the problem that is at hand, to also perhaps cause public opinion to force the vendors to change what they're doing. We've certainly seen the power of that in recent events and with the announcements of the strategic direction that Microsoft has taken in the last 6 months. Most of the adherents of this are commercial researchers, people who are actually getting paid to do this kind of work, and quite a few software vendors have come around to this as well. In the last year or two, most of the major software vendors actually now believe that it is a good thing to produce vulnerability information in the public and to make people aware of the information they need in order to understand that the patches and the fixes are necessary. And I know there are going to be some skeptics out there in the audience. Again, I'll be happy to discuss that when we get to the questions. Excuse me. But it is nevertheless true that at least in their stated intentions, most of the software vendors, especially the large ones, do in fact buy into this. Zero disclosure is sort of the other end of the spectrum from full disclosure, and the idea here is essentially that there is no need for the public to get involved here, that there is no good to be had by broadly disclosing vulnerability information beyond the immediate community of the vendor and the researcher, that the vendor will fix it and people should install their patches. When the vendors announce that there is a fix, people should just do it. They should trust their vendors. Right? And the author also should note is responsible and owns this information related to things. And there's some there is some law that supports this, most notably DMCA recently, actually pretty clearly reinforces this position with its prohibitions against reverse engineering and so forth. And I'll talk a little bit about recent events relative to that a little bit later too. Again, most software vendors pretty much believe this. Most of them don't really want any vulnerability information going out, generally for their own self-interests rather than any public interest. Lots of government actors as well, not all at all by any stretch of the imagination, but many don't think that there is any good to be had in vulnerability information being given out, and therefore it should not be done. And much of the public also, interestingly, doesn't think that there's a lot of good to be had in public disclosure. Most people, I'm sure if you go talk to your mother or your grandmother or your father or your grandfather for a lot of us and ask them about what the benefit is of somebody knowing how to hack into their computer, they won't think that there is much of one. Okay? And so that's generally where the public comes in. There's a variant of zero disclosure called limited disclosure, which is essentially the sharing of information is a good thing, but only within closed communities. The ISACs are a great example of that, where you share information about vulnerabilities and incidents and all sorts of other security-relevant information, but only within this closed community where there is no forward dissemination of that information. Right? It stays within the group of people who are interested in that and doesn't go any further. And there's another subsection that is also sort of in this camp, which is the sections of the underground that are interested in malicious taking advantage of vulnerabilities in a malicious way. There's no gain to be had in publicizing the vulnerabilities. Once they do that, somebody's going to fix it, and then it's going to take away all of their fun. Right? So you want to keep these things within the closed community of the trusted folks. You need to share it with somebody, or no one will know that you're any good at what you do. So that's, of course, where people make their mistakes and where law enforcement gets their handle in on things. But if you can manage to get over that particular piece of self-interest, then if you keep these things quiet, then there's a broad or a long window in which they can be taken advantage of until somebody else discovers it, essentially. So I gave you this little summary slide. It's in your proceedings there, so you can take a look at this. But this is the sort of the spectrum of the vulnerability of the disclosure ideologies, and a quick summary of some of the adherents. Okay. So who are the actors? Vendors and researchers, of course, vendors being defined broadly, not only as commercial entities, but really as anyone who is creating software. So, you know, Jim Bob, who goes off and does his open source thing, is considered a vendor for these purposes, and all the way up through something much more formalized like the Linux development community or the Apache Software Foundation, all the way up to commercial entities big like MindView, just to full disclosure, by the way, and up to, you know, big companies like Microsoft. Researchers range a gamut, and again, I have a sort of a subcategory of researchers, which I call the underground, loosely, again. The researchers are commercial, academic, we'll talk about those in more detail in just a minute. Governments, of course, not just ours, but others, all play a role here and wield power over this, and the media is an important factor, along with the public. We'll talk about these in each a little bit more detail. I've broken down the description of each of these actors into basically four categories. What motivates them, where they get their money from, which are sometimes connected, often connected, sort of what the interests of that party are, not necessarily only in terms of their self-interest, but also their political interests may come into play as well, and the power relation between the other actors. So in the case of vendors, the primary motivator for a software company is going to be shareholder value. Okay. They want to be keeping the stock price up, earnings per share, all that good stuff, profit. Financing is coming from the sale of software. And the interests are primarily in maintaining image and maintaining that value of the company as well. So limiting damage, limiting the vulnerability of their customers as well. This is another one that is somewhat open to discussion. Some people will argue that that software vendors, in fact, do not have any interest in limiting the vulnerability of their customers, except insofar as it affects their ability to sell more software and to limit their brand value, to damage their brand value. I think personally that that's an unfair characterization. I think that it is fair and true that the software vendors truly want to not have their customers vulnerable to security problems, not only for the reasons that it is true that they would become upset customers and it would damage their brand value and it would limit their ability to sell more software, but also intrinsically as a good thing. It is certainly true that there are exceptions to this, but I think that it is generally true that software companies and the people who make up those software companies, which is really what we're talking about, do in fact want their customers to be secure. It is evidenced in what they say and what they do. Most software vendors do in fact try to build secure software. Most fail abysmally, but that doesn't mean that they haven't tried. Okay. And so the power relations are fairly straightforward. In many cases, they'll try to prevent the public disclosure of vulnerability information, and it has become significantly less common for the companies to try to take legal action against the announcer of the vulnerability, with notable exceptions, such as one that came out this week with HP sending a warning to some researchers relating to a True64 vulnerability. So it is definitely still happening. Researchers have a variety of motivators. Generally, we're looking to advance the state of the art, looking to move forward, find new and interesting ways of breaking into systems for the purpose, usually, of building more security so that we can learn from the mistakes of the past and build more secure software in the future. That's pretty much what we're trying to do. And also, of course, to aggrandize ourselves, for lack of a better term, through the building up of name recognition and peer respect, doing good work, finding that clever new vulnerability, finding that new way of exploiting problems. Okay? Financing comes from a variety of sources. There are quite a few researchers who have a day job which is not research. And so they're system administrators, they're programmers, they're doing all sorts of things with their day-to-day lives that are not getting paid to do this kind of work. And so it's an important thing to keep in mind. The remainder, which are those are the non-commercial researchers. The commercial researchers are either getting it directly in the form of grant money or pay from a customer to actually do this investigation. There are a number of companies that are essentially security consulting companies, but find vulnerabilities in software as part of their, what they do. They get paid by some entity to go investigate a piece of software and try to find out if it's, if it is secure before it's used. And others from software sales. BindView, as well as other security companies, maintain security research teams that look for vulnerabilities, but are financing all of that through the sale of software. The major interests are to continue the financing and not therefore jeopardize their financing. So the, in the commercial case, you don't want to be, the commercial researchers don't want to be doing anything that's going to jeopardize their grant money or jeopardize their software sales. And in the on the non-commercial side, the researchers don't want to do anything that's going to jeopardize their day job, generally speaking, of course. Of course, maintaining and extending the reputation as a good person, somebody who's doing good work and is clever and all of those things that we all want to be. Okay. The power relations are a little bit more complicated for researchers. The non-commercial researchers are generally free from external influence. They can pretty much do whatever they want, provided that they're not jeopardizing the day job. Right? And that's often accomplished through the use of handles and anonymization to prevent somebody from making the connection between those two. So if I do a bad thing as a researcher or some, piss somebody off as a researcher, more to the point, that won't jeopardize the day job and, you know, have the problem of losing one's house or anything. You know, wouldn't get involved in a lawsuit, that sort of thing. Okay. Academic researchers, which I touched on only briefly, are mostly getting their funding from grants and are largely beholden to the funding source. The grants are often quite specific in what the research is going to be done, what research is to be done, and what is to be done with that research when it is finished. Generally speaking, it's not done under non-disclosure agreements, but is usually okay to be published. But it's still not something that you want to be. The academic researchers are generally very cognizant of what the interests of the granting authority is, and so will not be will be aware and careful not to annoy that source and jeopardize the possibility of future grants. Commercially sponsored researchers are, you know, they're working in a corporate entity, and the corporate entity has its specific needs and interests, which are generally related to the generation of revenue. And so we'll be pretty careful not to jeopardize any of that. And so pressure that can be brought to bear if from government and other power sources on that parent company will generally translate pretty directly into the researchers and limit their activities or control their activities. Subset of the underground. This is a broad category that includes a lot of different things, and it's essentially the same as other forms of research. But it I add a category here, which add a couple of points, which is the idea of knowing something that other people don't. This is a section. Again, we're speaking fairly loosely about what constitutes the underground here, but generally, black hats would be where we would be who we'd be putting into this category. And it's the folks who are wanting to keep vulnerability information to themselves and or within a limited forward disclosure, environment. So the idea of controlling a piece of information, knowing something that other people don't, is very important. Some financing for this kind of activity does in fact come from organized crime and other sources. Not much at this point. It's a very small amount that's coming from there, but it is there, and it's something that we should recognize when we talk about this stuff. And the interests are generally to keep software vulnerable. Lots of folks who are in the black hat community have no interest whatsoever in improving the security of systems, except insofar as the systems that they have already broken into and prevent other people from breaking into them as well. Right, so that's just keeping that in mind. And there's very little power involved here in either of being exerted on these folks or being exerted by these folks, except through the media in the creation of fear, uncertainty, and doubt. Governments are generally motivated by what I call the technocratic perception of public good. They generally are doing what they're doing because they think it's the right thing to do. How they arrive at what is the right thing to do is an extremely interesting question in and of itself. And it generally has to do with a lot of bureaucratic forces, the study of governments as a whole field and how they come up with things, and in this case of vulnerability disclosure is no different from that. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail on that. We could be here all day. But the thing to remember here is, in fact, that they want to keep, they do want to produce public good. They sometimes have a fairly twisted idea of what that is as a result of the organizational factors around them. Financing is from taxes, and in the case of elected officials, campaign contributions are a major thing. And so that the public actually does have a fair amount of power on shaping what the government does if the public can actually get it together to have an opinion, which is a problem. The interests of public safety and economic growth are should be fairly straightforward. Those are certainly things that that all governments want to produce. They don't want people to be in danger, and they don't want to jeopardize economic growth. So those are factors that will play into some of the public policy initiatives that we'll see coming up in just a couple slides. And the power is governments, of course, have a monopoly on authority. The government is the only actor here that can legitimately wield its power to cause people to do things that they would not otherwise do. And it does that primarily through law enforcement, but also as it is a major purchaser of information technology, which is an important factor with it for considering what they can do with vulnerabilities. In the case, pardon me, of the United States government, the purchasing authority is separated so widely within the government that no single entity actually wields that much power. So the federal government as a whole does, but it's all broken up and different folks, it's very difficult to concentrate that power for producing effects. The media is primarily interested in moving news, getting more people to read it, and getting the things out there that are interesting for people to read. The financing is coming through either advertisements or subscribers, and those can have very different effects on what editorial decisions are made by the particular outlet, depending on what the revenue source is. Sometimes it depends on a number of factors, but it's important to remember that both of those are major sources of revenue. The interest generally is in improving their reader base, getting more readers or viewers or whatever the particular media is, but getting more folks in there looking at their stuff, so that either as subscribers or imprints for the advertising. And the power relations media, again, wields a tremendous amount of power, particularly in the creation and destruction of brand and image for corporations and for individuals. Researchers who get picked up in the press will start to gain reputation and can influence public perception quite extensively. One statistic I'll throw out there for you on this one is that something on the order of 70% of Americans think that it is unsafe for them to shop online. Right. But they're concerned that their private information may be compromised. Right. Now, that may be a fair criticism or maybe a fair concern, but the fact of the matter is that they have very little actual damage that can be done to them by simply using a credit card online. Their liability for misuse of the credit card is limited by law to $50, which is a relatively small amount of money for most people. And the worst case scenario would be that the identity is stolen, which can be a real problem, but is a very small percentage of things that are actually taking place. It's not that common, and it's also the internet is not that big of a factor in the rate of identity theft. It is certainly increased. There's no question about that. But identity theft was around long before the internet. Will continue to be around after we've moved on to whatever is next. And it certainly is not the defining characteristic. So there's this very large amount of fear that is probably not statistically accurate. Okay? That it's probably not a legitimate, it's probably not statistically true it's probably not rational for this degree of fear to exist if you look at it objectively, and yet it does. Why? Primarily because of media coverage, primarily because of the coverage people have had to hackers and all these other things that have taken place. Everybody knows the internet's not secure. Right. The fact that it's not secure doesn't mean that you can't send a credit card across. It just means that it's not secure. We all know that. The public, which I've sort of alluded to on several cases here, is an interesting case, but the problem with it with regard to vulnerability disclosure is that there are generally too many factors for any single factor to rise to the top and be something that we can characterize as public opinion relative to these issues. Except is the interests here in the public does not seem to have any interest in secure software, at least as evidenced by what they were willing to pay for. And that's an important factor as well. They generally are much more motivated to spend by features and functionality within the software, and generally don't actually have, aren't willing to spend on stable and secure software, although they do state that they desire it. Yeah?
I'm not sure if this is the case, and it's not the case simply of the public has no way to know which is the secure software.
The statement was that there's a disputing my point here and saying that the issue is really that the public has no way of knowing what constitutes stable and secure software, and that's actually a good point. I agree to a certain extent, but there are. Even in cases where software is marketed extensively as being more secure, it doesn't appear that people are willing to spend money on that. And it's also true at the corporate level that when software that the security of the software is not something that people are willing to spend more money on. Right? That it's certainly a factor in making a decision, but it is not a defining factor. So we can talk about that more afterwards.
Excuse me, if I may.
Sure.
One thing real quick. I think one of the things that customers, the public, if you will, are seeing is that it's much more easy to get your hands on the WhizBang feature. It's much more easy to see perceived value in something like that rather than to actually see the value concretely in security. We all here know the value of secure software. But the average consumer or the average business consumer may not see anything real and tangible at that moment that they make their purchasing decision. So as a result of that, they're going to gravitate towards those things that have the features that they can lay their hands on and say, oh, wow, I have this thing in front of me and it's amazing. I can see value with this purchase.
Just for those of you who couldn't hear, the statement was that putting forth the theory that what's going on here is actually that people don't see value in the security feature, but they see it's easy for them to wrap their hands around functionality and other kinds of features, but it's very difficult for them to wrap their hands around the value of a security feature. Is that a fair characterization? Close enough? Okay. Great. So we'll move on to some of the policy initiatives that have been coming along. They range from, this is sort of vaguely chronological in the order that things have been taking place. The Council of Europe, oh, I won't read these, just go right into it. The cybercrime treaty that the Council of Europe signed a couple years ago, the intent here was to harmonize and update European computer laws that subsequently been signed on to by a number of other countries, including the United States. And an attempt to update all of these laws, and it's great, pardon me, from a law enforcement sense to be able to predict that somebody in Germany is going to be subject to similar laws relative to cybercrime as somebody in the United States or elsewhere, Switzerland, whatever, other countries. There are a couple of provisions within it which are problematic, one of which is that it makes the possession or recommends that the signatory countries make the possession of so-called hacker tools a crime in and of itself, similar to the possession of other kinds of controlled items. And the language in the cybercrime treaty is quite clear to include intent as part of this, that you have to have this with malicious intent, and also to have exceptions for legitimate security researchers. The problem primarily arises in that the treaty itself is not the law, and that each country has to then write their own laws, and there's a lot of potential there for misuse of those provisions that can really have a potentially chilling effect on security research. There are, I'm sure we can all imagine nightmare scenarios where people are prosecuted for having Loftcrack on their PC, for example, or other kinds of carrying around Nessus on their laptop, might produce prosecution. also, there's this language about legitimate security practitioners being able to do a lot of things that are otherwise a crime. I think will probably push us in the direction of leading to certification requirements for security practitioners, so that we'll be able to say, so that law enforcement authorities will be able to say, this is a legitimate security researcher, this is not. Right. Being able to draw those distinctions is something that is otherwise very difficult to do. The U.S. has been moving along quite aggressively in the creation of ISACs, the Information Sharing and Analysis Centers, vertical industry lines. They're up and running for financial services, the electrical grid. There's one in the works for healthcare. The information technology one is up and running. There are several others. Some are in the works. Most of these are being put together out of commerce. The idea here is for the member companies to sort of stay one step ahead of the bad guys, and also, has the effect of facilitating the government, information getting to the government. They've always complained that private industry has access to all this information about security problems on their networks and activities that are being put on the internet and being directed against them, but they never tell law enforcement about it, and law enforcement really wants to know. How about that? And the ISACs are a vehicle through which that information does, in fact, get to law enforcement, and it produces a lot of interesting data. It produces better intelligence about attacks for early warning of things that might be coming along that other companies have seen that might be coming after your company. There are a couple problems with these. One is that they can have a very chilling effect on public discussion insofar as the member companies will choose to discuss their issues within the ISAC itself rather than discussing it in a more public forum with a broader community of security folks. And so the result of that is that we have the people who know and the people who don't know. The people who are in the ISACs get to know all this stuff. The people who are outside the ISACs don't get to know it. The vision, of course, is that eventually most companies would be part of an ISAC. The information would bubble up to the government. The government would compile all of it and then give it all back out. Unfortunately, the government has a terrible record of giving anything back out, particularly as it relates to security. And so it remains to be seen whether or not that vision will actually come to pass. Disclosure forums are a major factor. It's sort of weird to put them in as a policy initiative, but it sort of fits at least in terms of the outcome and effect kind of analysis of them. The idea here is to get information out to people who need it. Pretty straightforward. All the security folks and system administrators subscribe to the mailing lists. You get the information about the vulnerabilities. Enough said. Right? The problem, of course, is that there's no control over who gets to be in these things. There's no way necessarily of really telling, a priori anyway, who the bad guys are and who the good guys are. Nobody wants to give information to the bad guys, but there's no real good way of drawing the line between who the good guys and the bad guys are. So we're left with the need to get it out to the broadest community of good guys that we can, and the price we pay for that is that the bad guys get it too. And so that's just the way it is. And there are a whole bunch of these. I'm sure we're all familiar with the various disclosure forums. The Organization for Internet Safety is a private company initiative. The idea here is essentially to promulgate the so-called responsible disclosure idea here, and thus to limit the amount of information that gets out to the bad guys at what time. The fundamental idea is to create a window of opportunity during which people can install patches on their systems before the bad guys get the information. To give out basically to the broad community a limited amount of information and the patch, okay, so that they can make the appropriate fixes, but then to not make the information, the details that the bad guys need available until later. It's an interesting idea. There are a couple of problems with it, obviously. There are plenty of bad guys out there who can figure out what the problem is from the patch. Don't need exploit code and don't need any additional details of the vulnerability in order to figure out what it is. But there is also a large community of bad people who do need that information and can't otherwise take advantage of that. Most known to most of us in this room, I'm sure, is script kiddies. They aren't going to be able to do much with just basic information, and they aren't going to be able to to reverse engineer the patch in order to figure out what's going on and then create their own exploits. So we're sort of locking out that community of exploiters is the idea. Right? It has the disadvantages, of course, in that it is limiting that detailed information to everybody, to academic researchers or other researchers who have a very legitimate interest in getting that information, to other kinds of security professionals and system administrators who may want to go and test their systems for vulnerability. That information may not be adequate detail for them to be able to do that. That's available in some of these other things. So this kind of thing can be very problematic in terms of what information, drawing the lines of what the appropriate level of information is in order to get the information that people do need to the people who need it, and try to not get the other information to the people who don't need it. It's another attempt to sort of solve the problem that's created by disclosure forums, and we'll see how it turns out over the next few years. The other thing I just want to mention here is that it has the potential for creating a chilling effect on research in general, insofar as some researchers may just decide that it's more trouble than it's worth to actually maintain relationships with software vendors and deal with some of these the issues that are arisen, that arise from the so-called responsible disclosure paradigm. So there are also various U.S. legislation efforts that are currently underway. There are FOIA and antitrust exemptions. FOIA, for anyone who doesn't know, is the Freedom of Information Act. And it's actually, they don't want to call it an exemption. They want to call it a clarification of an existing provision that's within within FOIA to prevent the government, to prevent information that private companies give to the government relative to security from then becoming subject to FOIA and being available in the press. And also, likewise, to exempt companies that share security information with each other, especially within the same industry, from being subject to allegations of collusion and other kinds of antitrust activities. There's been a big increase in funding for NIST and NSF-sponsored research. There are now graduate fellowships in information security. I believe that legislation, actually the legislation has not passed the Senate yet, but it is through the House. I think that will probably pass soon. Underway currently is a single gold standard for U.S. government security configurations. This is a kind of an interesting idea that they're putting together essentially a checklist of security for Windows 2000 initially, but we'll expand that out into other platforms for the purpose of having at least a baseline of system security that is higher than the defaults, and having that be something that everybody has to subscribe to, that you've got to get at least to this floor before you can do anything. That's good, right? That's a step in the right direction. FISMA is the Federal Information Security Management Act. It is the successor to GISRA, the Government Information Security Reform Act, which is expiring this year. FISMA is intended to be essentially a permanent replacement, and it essentially creates the requirement in federal agencies that they have to report their security stance, their configuration, their policies, and so forth, to a central authority within the federal government. And this is considered also to be a pretty good thing because what it will do is force people to consider what it is they're doing with their security. They have to make a report about it every year. They have to pay attention to what it is in order to create that report and satisfy the requirements of the law. And there may or may not actually be provisions in it for penalizing organizations that don't do well in order to take away money from what they are supposed to be doing and in order to give it to their information security stuff, which is sort of a problematic concept in and of itself. But the FISMA legislation passed the House last week as an amendment to H.R. 5005, which is the authorization bill for the Department of Homeland Defense, which is a really good political move, if I can say so that. Attaching it to something that's certainly going to pass was a good idea. Whether or not it'll get through the Senate is another matter entirely. We'll probably see that soon. And of course, we're probably all familiar with the DMCA and the Patriot Act. The DMCA has had a pretty major chilling effect on research. Possibly some of us were around last year when Mr. Skolarov was arrested at the convention. And there have been other provisions of sort of scare tactics around some of the provisions of the Patriot Act. There's another talk that covered those in more detail, so I won't go into that too much. So some of the trends that we're seeing. Increasing legislation, as we just saw on the last slide. This is an area that is coming up more and more on Capitol Hill, at least in this country. Probably going to be seeing more types of legislation coming out around this, more requirements for federal agencies, and probably eventually some requirements for private companies as well. There's actually talk about requiring companies to file annually with the SEC, public companies to file annually with the SEC, some kind of a statement about their information security stance, similar to the kinds of statements that were required for Y2K compliance. Basically saying, you know, we're aware of it, we're doing something, we're going to be compliant in time, was what the Y2K statements were like. They're not particularly detailed, but they were required as part of the full disclosure. Part of the disclosure statements that the companies had to make, which at least raises it to the level that the boards get to be aware that this is something that they need to pay attention to. Okay? And there will be all sorts of interesting problems that will come up as we go through these things, I'm sure. We'll also see, I think, better communication channels. The ISACs are proliferating, which is improving communication between companies, as well as between companies and the federal government. The InfraGuard program is one of several public-private partnerships that are out there for the sharing of information and getting everybody to be more aware of security. The bad guys are probably doing a better job too. They certainly do very well in the past in disseminating information amongst themselves without getting it out to the good guys, and that's probably something that's likely to continue. There's lots of research being done. The rate of new vulnerability announcements has been increasing at about 90% per year since 1992. The projection for this year, depending on how you count it, is somewhere between 1,400 and 2,500 new vulnerabilities to be announced in 2002. Yeah.
I've seen that same type of code used for different purposes. Is the source of that information or the cost of this because producing more junk software, or because communication is better, or because there's just more people working hard at the software?
I have the answer to I have my answer to that question two slides down. Hold that thought. right. So I think we will also continue to see more vicious attacks. NIMDA was extremely aggressive, but not particularly damaging, although because it was so dirty in the things that it did, it was pretty difficult to keep up with it and very expensive on the cleanup efforts. We'll probably see a more damaging internet worm soon, I think. And of course, more internet access is going to lead to more and more possibilities for things to run rampant and disrupt our daily lives as these things go forward. Just a couple of probabilities, I think. And these are my own opinions, so I'd be happy to talk with folks. We're running out of time quickly, so I'm going to have to do the questions probably offline. But I'll be happy to talk with folks. Who will pay for security is an interesting question, actually. Somebody's going to pay for it, and it's not going to just happen all on its own. And there are basically only three possibilities, and really only two possibilities when you think about it, for who's going to pay for it. Either the consumers of the software or the government are going to pay for it, one way or another. And in the end, it's going to be the consumers anyway. It all comes back to the consumers anyway. And so whether or not they're going to be willing to do that, without being required to do it, will be an interesting question, I think. People were discussing also the HP DMCA threat. I thought it was an interesting contrast with Mr. Clark's statement yesterday that we all had essentially a moral obligation to be seeking vulnerabilities in software, and yet that activity is essentially illegal, according to DMCA. And that's an interesting line to try to walk. With the HP thing, we're actually if there is prosecution relative to this, it'll be interesting to see how it does. This could be a good case to really test the law, get it through the courts, and see what happens. I mean, you feel sorry for the folks who are on the other end of it, but from the outside, it's an interesting case. The increasing regulation, I think, will probably have more effect on getting security out to people. Mostly, we've seen the beginnings of that through HIPAA and GLBA. NCSA is the National Cybersecurity Alliance, which is something that Richard Clark's office has put together, and that's really pushing consumer security, and which is really a great thing. They're doing a good job with that. And will the liability laws change? Everybody always wants to talk about this as part of the as part of these things, and it's not. I personally, it's not going to change anytime soon. There's too much risk to the increasing productivity that we've seen over the last 10 years in the economy through the improvement of information technology for anyone in government to want to risk that. Okay. So wrapping up. I don't think that there are any major changes that we're going to see anytime soon here. We're sort of drifting in the direction, this is the answer to your question, we're drifting in the direction of more secure software as software engineering does slowly improve over time, as companies get better at building more secure software. But most of that progress, if not all of that progress, I think is being offset by the astronomical increases in complexity of that software. And all of us, I'm sure, believe and are aware that complexity is the antithesis of security when it comes to software. That I think is what's responsible for the increasing rate. The complexity is increasing a lot faster than our software engineering science is improving, and that's why we're seeing more vulnerabilities. And so we would do questions, except we're out of time. So if you have any questions, I'll be out in the hall at the end, and I'll be happy to chat with everybody. Thanks for coming. Sure. Thank you.